Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Dark Things podcast. This is season 3, episode 9. I'm Hunter, alongside with Andrew today, and we're going to be discussing the Dyatlov Pass incident, which I don't know if you know much about, Andrew.
Yeah, so I remember back in the day when we were talking about podcasting, like a long time ago, you were telling me about like Necronomipod, and you were telling me to listen to the Dyatlov Pass, and I was like, all right, let's check it out. Because I was never, you know, a huge fan of true crime, but then I like checked it out and listened to it. I was like, oh my God, this is creepy as fuck.
Yeah, it's a super interesting mystery. So before we get into that, though, we do have a couple announcements. As you all know, we've taken a little bit of a break. So a couple announcements. We are back. We're going to be trying as hard as we can to be releasing an episode every single Sunday for everybody. But we're also going to be discussing our Patreon.
Yeah. So let me hop into that real quick. We'll be linking to our Patreon to our Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all those good things, and you'll be able to find that there. But let me go ahead and just hop into some of our tiers. So at the basic tier for Dark Light, we have $1.99 per month. This is going to give you, one, the ability to support our podcast, because obviously this isn't free. Like, we have to pay monthly subscription fees to like even host this stuff. But that money will also go to you being shouted out at the end of our weekly episode when you subscribe. And then you'll also get the ability to suggest new episodes. So if you've listened to other true crime podcasts, or if you've heard of something creepy or mysterious and you want us to cover it, you can definitely use a Google Form link and you'll be able to give us unlimited suggestions, and we'll definitely take those into consideration. Upping that membership to the Dark Apprentice, this is $6 per month, so that's $4 more about. And with this, you get the whole Dark Light subscription plus the Dark Apprentice one, which is going to include 2 bonus episodes a month. So basically every other week, you're going to get the ability to listen to premium content that's not getting released to everyone else. On top of that, you're also going to get our show notes a week early, so you'll be able to see what we're talking about before we release that episode, and you'll be able to see all the things that we actually say in that episode. And then last but not least, we have a Dark Master. This is $10 per month. And with this one, you get both of those subscriptions plus the Dark Master subscription. You're going to get the full ability to drive the direction of our podcast. You can give us feedback like, hey, we don't like how long the episodes are. We'll definitely reduce them. You have like complete control over everything. But you'll also get the 4 episodes every single month extra. So you'll get 1 a week, and you're going to get all of our episodes a day early. So you get a day early before everyone else. You get 4 extra once a week. And then once you've subscribed for, I think we're still going to decide, maybe 3 to 6 months, we'll give you a free t-shirt after you've been subscribed for a period of time. And then you also get a Q&A session with me and Hunter once a month on a Zoom meeting.
And you can also vote to rename Dark Master to Dark Daddy.
Dark Daddy.
Anyways, yeah, we just, the idea of Patreon came to us. We did try to add in like, you know, a couple 15 second ads to the beginning and ending of the show. However, we did get rejected by the ad company, because apparently we're too vulgar, but I'm going to blame Andrew for that.
Yeah, so apparently we swear too much, and that's a given. Like, me and Hunter definitely don't watch our language at all, but I mean, we should freaking stop, obviously. apparently our Toy Box Killer kind of gave us a lot of riled up people getting into our podcast.
So. But on the contrary, that was our most downloaded episode. So if you haven't listened to the Toy Box Killer, you do have a strong stomach, definitely go back and do that. That episode was great for us.
Oh yeah, definitely. And like you were saying before, it's definitely the tag. Like, just saying it was extremely graphic, I think, pulled people into it.
But sickos.
Freaking freaks of nature. but yeah, like, so I guess to give you the whole rundown, we literally got an email from Audio Boom, who hosts our show, and they're like, yeah, we can't put ads in your stuff because you guys are way too explicit. You have way too many, or too much adult content, which I was just telling Hunter about. I'm like, this is ridiculous, because we literally put the explicit tag on every single episode. Like, we've mentioned it's not for children. It's not for anyone that's younger than 18. This is for adults. So
maybe they just listened to that. They listened to the Toy Box Killer and they're like, oh, hell no, we're not giving these guys any money.
Fuck these guys. So long story short, me and Hunter are basically going to be denied of ads. So even if we wanted to do ads, we can't. You know, part of the reason why we're doing Patreon, because we want you guys to support our podcast. And if you really love it, we want to like give you stuff back, like more episodes, more stuff. And obviously podcasts aren't free. We've got to pay for our hosting services, like all of our editing stuff. We got to like make the money back on all the money we put into this gear, you know,
And on top of that, we still love doing, we don't do this for the money at all. No. We do this just for our own enjoyment, for our own research. So we're going to keep continuing to have our free weekly shows, and we do appreciate all your support.
Yeah.
Don't feel obligated to support the Patreon. However, if you want that extra content as well as a little bit more quality content, then
yeah,
you can definitely support us on Patreon, and we would appreciate that.
Definitely.
So,
and for those as well, just to hop in real quick, if we do merch down the later, which sounds like we are, feel free to, like, you know, support us in that way. Like, obviously Patreon's a huge commitment. So once we get merch out there, you know, buying stickers or like a shirt, like that's more than enough, you know, and you get to support the show and rip it for us, you know?
Definitely. Any way to support us is great. And like we've said before, the best way to support us is just give us a good review on the platform you listen to.
Definitely.
We appreciate that so much. So we'll go ahead and start with today's show. Like I was saying, this is season 3, episode 9. We're coming up next week on our finale. We're excited about that. No spoilers though. And then for season 4, I've been having a couple ideas. Maybe we should drop a teaser for that.
All right. I'm down.
You want me to drop a teaser for season 4?
Drop the teaser right now, bro.
We're thinking of doing a 3-part series. 2 to 3 parts, depending on. You know where the saying drinking the Kool-Aid comes from?
I've definitely heard the saying. I don't know where it's from.
Okay, well, I'm not going to tell you, but that's your hint.
Ooh.
Kool-Aid.
Hey, drop us a comment on one of our posts. Tell us where this
Andrew's like, I have no idea what the hell he's talking about.
Nah.
Anyways, okay, well, that's going to be season 4, so we're looking forward to that. But right now, we're going to jump into episode 9 of season 3. This is the Dyatlov Pass incident. I've been pretty interested about this story and this mystery for a while. As many of you do know, me and Andrew used to live in Russia. We went on a service mission, taught English, taught people about a church there. And this incident happened not far from where we used to live, called Yekaterinburg.
Yeah.
In the Soviet times, it was known as Sverdlovsk, but today it's now known as Yekaterinburg. It straddles the Ural Mountains, and it's in the western Siberian plain. So this takes place in 1959, when a group of skiing expeditioners journeyed across the northern Urals in the Sverdlovsk Oblast of the Soviet Union. Igor Dyatlov was a 23-year-old radio engineering student at the Ural Polytechnic Institute, and he was the leader who assembled this group of 9 others, most of whom were fellow students and peers at the university. Each member of the group, which consisted of 8 men, 2 women, was an experienced grade 2 hiker. So I guess in the Soviet Union, they would like give you grading based off of how well you could hike or swim or bike or, you know, anything like that, skiing. So grade 2 hiker, I guess is pretty, it's like mediocre.
Okay.
And they were going on this trip so that they could get their grade 3 certification, which was like a national certification. You know, Soviet Union, they give out medals for literally do everything.
Yeah, legit.
Like, oh, you haven't called in sick to work for a year. Here's a medal. You know, we would walk around and there would just be like people with these massive jackets with like
all their medals.
You've seen those pictures of like North Korea with all the generals with the medals.
Yeah,
they're like participation awards. So I guess that's, you know, it's the government trying to make them feel good. So this trip was scheduled so that they could all get their grade 3 certification. And reading about Dyatlov Pass and this whole trip, I mean, it sounds like it was very difficult. I'm not trying to short sell the difficulty of this. It was definitely, I mean, you know, Andrew, you lived in Russia. It's freezing cold.
Oh, yeah, easy.
And these people are doing this in the middle of the winter.
Well, I mean, let's just like touch on this for a second. I don't know if you had this happen, but I think it was in Chelyabinsk, which is like Tankograd back in the day. We literally were outside. It was negative 40 degrees Celsius, which is when it matches up with negative 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And I literally remember their freaking like bus system broke down. It was so cold.
Mm-hmm.
Like literally just stopped in the street. They opened the doors. We all got out and had to walk the rest of the way. Like it's that freaking cold. Like cars don't even work.
I remember one time when it was negative 40. It got to, I think, negative 43 there one time.
Oof.
When I was out on the street. And it was to the point where it feels like you're swallowing needles.
Yeah.
When you take a breath. And that's even with like a scarf and a shirt over your face.
Yeah.
And it's to the point where your eyes also feel like pinpricks because they're starting to freeze, like the liquid around your eye starts to freeze. And literally your nose, it's so cold that your nose starts to run and it will literally form icicles around your nose.
Legit.
As well.
Well, like, okay. And also like, I don't think Americans understand, maybe even Europeans that live in like the more Western regions understand how cold it is there. Cause you legit can't get by like a normal coat you could pick up at Walmart or Target or, you know, any other like low quality market store. Like we had to spend $200 plus on our jackets. Because
like a Canada Goose jacket. Yeah. You need to have like a Canadian brand exactly. heavy duty down jackets to survive there.
Well, it's like, what is it? I think Russia was marked as like, no matter what it is, if it's windy, it feels like it's 20 degrees less than what it actually is. Like that wind is like biting. Like it freaking hurts, you know?
Definitely. So, and we'll keep that in mind as we talk about this story today, just because, you know, it would be absolutely miserable to be out in that kind of winter, especially with, you know, like clothing in the 1950s, I feel wasn't very advanced, you know? Yeah. It's just kind of like, it's not anything we have today. Like we have goose down jackets and right. fur and all this stuff. And they had that obviously back then, but you know, just keep that in mind as we talk about what happens in this story. So the route was designed by Dyatlov's group to reach the far northern regions of the Sverdlovsk Oblast, which is basically the state, which Yekaterinburg is the capital of.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to go up the upper streams of the Lozva River. The route was approved by the Sverdlovsk City Route Commission, and the goal of the expedition was to reach the Gora Oriton, which was a mountain 10 kilometers north of the site, or 6.2 miles for our American friends, where the tragic incident would occur. This route, undertaken in February, was estimated as a Category 3, the most difficult time to traverse this mountain.
Yeah. All right, so the Dyatlov group left Sverdlovsk City, which is today Yekaterinburg, on the 29th of January in 1959. The group eventually arrived by train to Ivdel, Ivdel. So that's a town at the center of the northern province of Sverdlovsk Oblast in the early morning hours of January 25th, 1959. They then took a truck to Vizhai, a village that is the last inhabited settlement to the north. While spending the night in Vizhai, the skiers purchased eight loaves of bread to keep their energy levels up for the following day's hike. On January 27th, they began their trek toward Gora Oriton. It's like, if it's in Russian, it's easier for me to read. I'm like, these English like ways of saying it are hard. But yeah, on January 28th, one member, Yuri Yudin, suffered from several health ailments, including congenital heart defect, and then turned back due to knee and joint pain that made him unable to continue the hike. The remaining nine hikers continued on the trek. So this guy just kind of walked back. Is that what I'm getting?
I don't think he walked back. I think he just went back to the village and they took care of him there. Having a heart defect would not be fun to keep skiing.
No, hell no.
For 24 hours a day. Exactly. Just skiing like crazy.
So now we got nine hikers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So on the 31st of January, the group finally arrived at the edge of a highland area and began to prepare for climbing. In a wooded valley, they cached surplus food and equipment that would be used for the trip back. The next day, the hikers started to move through the pass. It seemed they planned to get over the pass and make camp for the next night on the opposite side, but because of worsening weather conditions, the snowstorms and decreasing visibility, they lost their direction and they deviated west than what they had planned. When they realized their mistake, the group decided to set up camp right there on the slope of the mountain, rather than move the 1.5 kilometers downhill to a forested area that would have offered some more shelter for the weather. So, oof. I think that was their main mistake, is camping on this slope of the mountain, because this is where things start going down.
See, like, all right, I'm already sketched because like they had to move off the trail. But like, why are you hiking when there's a freaking snowstorm? Why?
Because they're Russian.
Yeah. No Russian.
They're just like, ah, snow. Figna. Snow, you know?
I'm just trying to remember all my Russian
snow is just nothing for these guys, probably. No. That's kind of crazy, like that they just kind of decided to just set up camp right there. I guess it's better than continuing not knowing what you're getting into, but
keep going.
Camping on the slope of a mountain doesn't sound very smart to me.
No.
Like, I would have rather gone down into the forested area if there was like you know, strong winds or an avalanche, anything like that.
Yeah. So. Kind of speaks to why they're a level 2 and not a level 3 certified hiker. They don't know what the fuck they're doing.
I wouldn't have given them that third certification, level 3.
Yeah, no. Fuck no. Well, it's like, I don't know. Like, how bad is a hiker level 2? Like,
like, it's just weird. Like, hey, I'm a hiker level 2.
Is this like their IQ level, you know, type of stuff?
Like, what kind of test they have to take? Who knows? If you survive, you're level 3.
Yeah.
So before leaving, Dyatlov had agreed he would send a telegram to their sports club as soon as the group returned to Vyzhai on the way back. It was expected that this would happen by February 12th. So that's kind of crazy also, this timetable, because this is the 31st of January, and he's saying that they're expected to be back February 12th. So they're literally out in these woods for 13 straight days.
Yeah.
Probably having to find their own food, all that kind of stuff on their hike. So Dyatlov had told Udine before he departed from the group that he expected it to be a little bit longer. When the 12th passed and no messages had been received, there was no immediate reaction, as delays of a few days were common for such expeditions. However, on the 20th of February, the traveler's relatives demanded a rescue operation, and the head of the institute sent the first rescue groups, consisting of volunteer students and teachers. Later, the army became involved with planes and helicopters ordered to join the operation.
Okay, can we, like, this is all like a bunch of hogwash, right? Because, like, this is 8 days that they start sending out, like, volunteer people to start looking for people. Like, if it's that cold and they can't find food, they're dead in 2 days.
Oh, absolutely. Even a day. Yeah. So I guess, well, it's, and he said that he would send them the telegram by the 12th, announced the 20th. So
right.
8 days have elapsed since he said he was going to send him a telegram. So I don't know. Maybe they thought there was some hope.
Yeah.
But yeah. And the army becomes involved. And that's another key thing I want to talk about, is the army getting involved.
Yeah.
That's kind of fishy as well, you know?
Definitely.
Because I feel like you wouldn't have this major mobilization of army, planes, helicopters, just, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I think that it, sending out just your normal rescue groups and first responders would have been enough, but...
Yeah. Well, it's like, it speaks to two things. Either it was, like, that bad they had to bring in the army, or, like, it was a cover-up.
Exactly. And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about what we think happened. So at this point, they're missing.
Yeah.
At this point, they're missing, and their friends are sending out expedition groups to look for them, and now the army's involved.
Right. I wonder if there was any cover-up with the families, because there's no way the families waited 8 days after the telegram was to be sent to demand a rescue mission. Like, there's got to be...
You never know, though. You never know. Because it is the 50s, and we're in the Soviet Union, and they are far away from civilization, so maybe they just thought... They just kept holding on hope and hoping and hoping, and then finally after 8 days, they're just like, no, we need this to happen now. You never know.
Yeah, okay, that's fair.
I don't know if the families would cover anything up like that. I don't think they would have the power to do that.
No, I'm not implying the families are covering up anything, but I wonder if the communication from the families to, like, the government was covered up. Like, if this was an ongoing, like, day by day, they're like, go fucking get our kids back, and then government's there, like, no, like, it's not.
There is a lot of records surrounding this that the Russian people themselves actually have demanded to see, and it's a completely closed file.
Oh, shit.
They've never, the former Soviet Union, I guess the Russians now, who have those files, the files have either been destroyed or they're missing.
That's bad.
So there clearly is a cover-up with secrecy around this.
Fuck. All right. So... On February 26th, the searchers found the group's abandoned and damaged tent. The campsite baffled and the search party. Mikhail Sherevin, the student who found the tent, said the tent was half torn down and covered with snow. It was empty, and all the group's belongings and shoes had been left behind. Investigators said that the tent had been cut open from the inside. 9 sets of footprints left by people wearing only socks or a single shoe, or even barefoot, could be followed, leading down to the edge of a nearby woods. On the opposite side of the pass, 1.5 kilometers to the northeast, after 500 meters, these tracks were covered with snow. At the forest edge, under a large Siberian pine, the searchers found the visible remains of a small fire. There were the first two bodies, those of, ooh, I can't even say that name, Kirvanshenko and Doroshenko, shoeless and dressed only in underwear. The branches on the tree were broken up to 5 meters high, suggesting that one of the skiers had climbed up to look for something. Between the pine and the camp, the searchers found 3 more corpses, Dilatov, Kolomogrova, and Slobodin, who died in poses suggesting that they were attempting to return to the tent. They were found at distances of 300, 480, and 630 meters from the tree. Big oof.
Yeah, so it's already a huge mystery right now. Like, why don't they have shoes on when it's that cold? Why are some of them in their underwear? Why are they all scattered about in crazy positions?
I mean, okay, so let's just hypothesize here, right? Like, if they're clawing or cutting it open from the inside. Like, it's got to be bad, right? If you're not going to even open the tent door and you're cutting it open from the inside, like, one, either the door was jammed or like blocked, or someone was in the doorway or something. Like, I don't know. It's just, it's not first impression that you grab a knife and try to cut it open from the inside. Like, that's. No.
And you're obviously in a hurry if you don't even bring shoes.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to run out into the freezing Siberian weather wearing only your underwear and no shoes at all. Like, right. We're talking, this snow is a couple feet deep.
Fuck.
And these people are just running with no shoes, socks, clothes on to get away from either, you know, we'll talk about some of the things that are suspected, like an avalanche.
Yeah.
Per se. But then again, the tent wasn't covered in snow.
Right. That's, yeah.
The tent was just there and it was cut open. And the bodies were visible, most of them. There were a couple that were covered with a little bit of snow. Obviously, that's bound to happen.
Right.
When it's wintertime in the middle of the woods, you're going to get some snow drifts that cover the bodies. But overall, it wasn't like in your normal case of an avalanche where people are buried under like 10 feet of snow.
Right. You
know? These are just barely covered with like a foot.
So we can immediately say this was not an avalanche, right? Because the tent would not be in that kind of shape and you wouldn't know.
We will get into the medical examination, and I'm pretty confident to say this was not an avalanche based on the evidence that the tent wasn't covered in snow and there were no outside physical injuries to the bodies.
Right.
Meaning that if, you know, if there were rocks and trees, and all, that's another thing, the landscape wasn't disturbed. And this mountain range, I don't even think is tall enough to have an avalanche. I mean, This is a hill, basically. Well, yeah,
and especially Russia, there were no mountains.
This isn't like the Rocky Mountains we know today. This is like the Ural Mountains. They're basically hills
at
some point, you know, steeper at some point than others. But these aren't going to have huge, massive avalanches that are going to kill people like in the Alps or in the Rocky Mountains or anything like that.
Before we'll
get into the medical examination, there's radiation found in the bodies as well.
Oh, shit. Well, okay, what would that have to be then? Because, like, they would know if they were getting radiation poisoning before they set up camp there, right? Or no?
I mean, we're talking high amounts of radiation. If it was radiation poisoning over the course of a few days, it would have been a lower amount. But this was, like...
insane amounts?
Big amounts. Like, either it was a machine that had exploded or, you know, something that spewed radiation. That could have been a lot of things in the Soviet Union, but...
yeah.
Well, but it's just, it's crazy. And go ahead and look at that next portion, and it will talk more about how they died.
Okay, I'll definitely read that, because I want to talk about that freaking walking in bare feet. Jesus Christ, you know? All right, let me see where we at. Finding the remaining, right? Okay, finding the remaining four travelers took more than 2 months. Jesus. They were finally found on the 4th of May under 4 meters, which is 13 feet of snow, in a ravine further into the woods from the pine tree. Three of the four were better dressed than the others, and there were signs that those who had died first had their clothes relinquished to the others. Dubinina was wearing Krivonshenko's burned, torn trousers, and her left foot and shin were wrapped in a torn jacket.
So we can assume that they all didn't die at the same time.
No.
I mean, probably... and that's another thing that's interesting is the 4 meters of snow. But I mean, that could also accumulate over 2 months of time also.
Yeah. And this was added that this was past the pine tree, right?
Yes. This is down in the ravine.
And so it said that further. The footsteps were like covered up by snow after the pine tree. So like, that sounds like a cover up. Like if the foot, you know, traces were like removed and then these guys are found under the snow, like really badly buried or buried well.
Underneath a snow drift. And what's interesting to note about it is how Dubinina was wearing one of the guys' jacket, and the jacket was burned, and the trousers were torn. So there had to have been some type of a struggle, don't you think?
Oh, shit.
And then her left foot and shin were wrapped in a torn jacket, kind of like a splint, meaning that her left foot had been damaged somehow.
Gotten hit by something.
So there's burn marks, there's torn trousers, and there's like a splint from one of the girls who had wrapped the foot up in a torn jacket.
Right. I'm wondering, because the burn, unless it was from other sources, which means that something came into play here, would have to be from the fire that was built by the tree. That's like the only, because maybe like they were so cold that she like was trying to get close to the fire for warmth and accidentally burned the jacket. Because like, I have a story when I was a kid, we had a teepee we were sleeping in, and obviously with teepees, you build the fire in the middle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I got my shoes wet. I was like 8 at the time, so my dad put my shoes by the fire pit. And then I had moved them closer because I wanted them to warm up faster. And obviously, if you put shit really close to the fire, my shoes were plastic, they started burning.
Yeah, so. And if especially if there's hypothermia involved, you can't really feel your extremities that well, so it could have burned the jacket and she might not have even known.
Yeah.
Another thing with hypothermia, if it's bad enough, it can make you feel like you're overheating.
No way.
It can. So, like, to the point where you're so cold, you'll just literally strip down all your clothes to try to get cooled off.
Goddamn.
Like, so that's another, that's something else that could have come into play here with them. But if you're in a tent and you're freezing to death, that's probably the last thing. Like, you'd think that all of your friends and, like, comrades, would tell you not to do that, you know?
Yeah,
definitely. Or try to keep each other warm. So, just thinking about all this, we'll go ahead and get into a little bit more of the investigative side. So there was a medical examination done. They found that one of the groups, that he was named Slobodin. He had a small crack in his skull, but it was not thought to be a fatal wound.
Interesting.
An examination of the other four bodies found shifted the narrative of the incident. Three of the hikers had fatal injuries. The Beau Brignoles had major skull damage. Dubnina Zolotarov had major chest fractures, and according to the doctors, the force required to cause such damage would have been extremely high, like that of a car crash. Like, this could not have been inflicted by a human.
Jesus.
Like, me punching you or even whacking you with something in the chest, there's no way that this force could have been even remotely close to what this girl had happened to her. So it was comparable to that of a car crash, the chest injury.
My God.
Avalanche could have done that. A missile could have done that. You know, those forces of nature. But this is not something that could have been done by a human.
Right.
There were no external wounds on any of the bodies, and the bone fractures had been subjected to a high level of internal pressure. Mm. So, like I said, no external issues at all. It was all internal.
Yeah.
Meaning that, you know, it's all pressure. It's all based on pressure, and it could have been something. I mean, I'm not going to rule out the avalanche, but it still doesn't explain a lot of the things. I'm not going to rule out a missile test, and we'll get into that because that would explain the radiation.
Well, it's like everyone knows the Russians were doing that, and they're like, really, you know.
Definitely, and it's the middle of nowhere. We did that in the U.S., you know, in New Mexico, Arizona. We're testing nuclear missiles and all that. Further examination. Let's see. All four bodies found at the bottom of the creek in a running stream of water had soft tissue damage to their head and face. But obviously they're in a running water, so that makes sense. For example, Dubina was missing her tongue, eyes, part of her lips, as well as facial tissue, as well as a fragment of her skull bone. That can probably be attributed to wild animals. The tongue, the eyes, any of those really soft tissues, they're going to be going first when animals, especially if the whole body's frozen.
Yeah, and that's typically normal scavengers. Mm-hmm. Like,
that's pretty normal, so I don't see any issue with that. Zolotarov had his eyeballs missing, and Alexander Kolovatov had his eyebrows missing.
Interesting.
That is interesting. Vorodyezhny, right, however you say that. The forensics expert performing the post-mortem examination judged that these injuries happened post-mortem due to the location of the bodies in a stream. So,
okay,
like we said, basically it was probably animals that had picked away at those people's faces.
So I am curious, though, like, Never mind, let's keep going.
Okay, yeah, just cut me off if you want to say anything. So the temperature was very low. It was around negative 20 to negative 35 degrees Celsius. So Fahrenheit, that's about negative 13 to negative 22. With a storm blowing, however, would have been a lot colder. And the dead were found only partially dressed. Some had only one shoe. Others wore only socks. Some were found wrapped in snips of ripped clothing from others. And that seemed to have been cut from those who were already dead as well. So they were literally trying to get as many clothes as they could around them.
Damn. So I want to hop in here for a quick second just because, like, I'm really sketched out by, like, okay, parks, like national parks in the U.S. If you follow, like, any Reddit page or any, like, forum, like, there's some really sketchy missing person cases when it comes to national parks.
Definitely.
I think there's two theories. One, that the government's, like, doing something. And then two, the other option is serial killers are naturally going to national parks because you're kind of, like, if you're backpacking, like I've done in California with my friend Jack, they told us, like, once you get past
what park did you go to?
We went to Yosemite,
and that one has a major issue with
rating
with missing people.
Yeah. And with that, there's like, I don't know, I got sketched out and that's why I got scared. And with this backpacking trek, I almost like bailed. Cause like they literally said, do not wear red, I think it was, because they're like, most people that wear red go missing.
Oh damn.
And they're like, it's because it's a highly visible color. And I was like, okay, so that like makes it even more creepy. But then also when I went there, they tell you like, once you hike up about, I think 3 miles and you get like up above the ridge, they're like, you can camp anywhere you want for like 50 miles out, which is kind of like scary. Like you could literally go wherever you wanted. And I feel like it's the people that do that, that go missing.
Yeah. That reminds me of this documentary I was watching. I think it was even by National Geographic.
Yeah.
But they took all these people on the show and were talking about missing people in national parks.
Yeah.
And it just gave me the chills thinking about it. But like a family will be hiking and they'll literally be having a conversation with the person right behind them.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden the person right behind them just isn't saying anything. They'll turn around
and they're gone.
Within 3 seconds of them saying the last word, they've vanished completely.
No, legit. So there's some couple theories I want to bring up real quick just to see if this ties into this. But I know with national park theories, they've got some crazy shit. Like one, it's always freaking hairy, tall people, Sasquatches. Bigfoot? Yeah.
Okay.
So there's always a theory that Sasquatches, like, because they're really like big and they can be like subtle because they obviously live out there, are like able to like grab and then run because they're like superhuman, right? And then the second thing is like there's some crazy thing with like a type of rock. I want to say it's granite, but I guess they were like saying you can go into another dimension based on if you like touch a certain rock or if you like stand in a certain space based on like sunlight and something like that. Super far-fetched, I know. But they were basically saying that you could just be teleported to another dimension in like a moment's notice. And then third option is obviously abduction. Like they're saying secret passageways that are like hidden to look like rock where you walk past them and they can pull you in and it closes.
Who would do that? The government?
Yeah, that'd have to be the government option.
Have you heard about feral people?
Oh, shit. Yeah, yeah. So I heard that there's some like ex-military veterans that live in Yosemite. And I guess like the government's covered it up. But I guess they like branded off after the war because they're like, fuck the government. Why did they put us in this situation? And apparently they went up into Yosemite with all their like war materials and the government hasn't been able to get them out. Like that's a theory. And really? So the government's hit it up, but there's like feral people out there, but they're like ex-vets living out there.
Sounds like we need to do a show on this separately.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, we'll keep that in mind.
But anyway.
Yeah, your interest, that's really interesting, seriously, about all that, because that stuff freaks me out too.
Just to tie it in, because I'm like, I have a feeling this might be correlated. But anyway, let's keep going.
Yeah.
Do you want me to go over the next part?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so is it the journalist bullet points? Mm-hmm. Okay, journalists reporting on this available parts of the inquest files claim that it states, 1/6 of the group members died of hypothermia and 3 of fatal injuries. 2, there were no indications of other people nearby apart from the 9 travelers. 3, the tent had been ripped open from within. 4, the victims had died 6 to 8 hours after their last meal. 5, traces from the camp showed that all group members left the campsite of their own accord on foot. 6, high levels of radiation were found on only 1 victim's clothing. And then 6, there were no survivors.
We'll never know. The end. No, I'm just kidding.
Wait, hold up. So what I'm seeing here is like each of the group members left the campsite of their own accord. So they did not leave all together. They all left separately.
They were found all at varying different, their bodies at least were found at varying stages throughout, like, you know, somewhere at 300 meters away, somewhere at 480, that kind of thing.
Huh.
They were not all together. The body, like some bodies, like pair of bodies were found together, like in the creek and in the ravine, but overall everybody left on their own accord, meaning that they all just got the hell out of there.
Fuck. Interesting. That's, dude.
Whatever happened.
Yeah. Huh.
So, and another thing is they all didn't die at the same time either, which I find really interesting because if it was like a missile that came down and hit them, I feel like they all would have been died.
Oh yeah, immediately.
They all would have died rather than having, you know, unless they all had like internal hemorrhaging and stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just don't think that that's very plausible because I feel like they all would have died if it was a missile. Also, no missile explosion debris was found around there.
Yeah, and there's only radiation on one person's jacket. Mm-hmm, like, on they would have all had radiation on something.
Yeah. You know? So, at the time of the official verdict was that the group members had died because of a compelling natural force. That was the official, you know, an unnatural force. Or, sorry, a compelling natural force killed all of them. And obviously, that probably happened, but I want to know the specifics.
Yeah, definitely.
The inquest officially ceased in May 1959 as a result of the absence of a guilty party. So they couldn't find anybody to blame, so they kind of just closed case it and The files were sent to a secret archive, and we still don't have any of that information today.
Sketchy. All right. Should we go bullet point by bullet point?
Let's go through it. We're going to go through some of the theories now.
Okay. What the fuck happened? Number one, at the time, the official verdict was that the group members had died because of a compelling natural force, which is what we talked about, possibly an avalanche. And then the inquest officially ceased, obviously, as Hunter said, in 1959, as a result of the absence of the guilty party. The files were then sent to a secret archive. So, yeah, I mean, we can pretty much rule that out because of where they were camping and it being on a hill and like the tent was still there. So
I don't think it was an avalanche.
No avalanche.
And another thing is like, I feel like the whole campsite and everything would have been buried.
Yeah.
If it was an avalanche. So this one I like, and I find it kind of a cool theory. There was also initial speculation that the indigenous Mansi people and their reindeer herders local to the area, the indigenous people of Siberia, had attacked and murdered the group for encroaching upon their lands. Several Mansi were interrogated, and investigation indicated that the nature of the deaths did not support their hypothesis. Only the hikers' footprints were visible, and they showed no sign of hand-to-hand struggle. To dispel the theory of an attack by the indigenous Mansi people, Vorodyezhny stated that fatal injuries of the three bodies could not have been caused by human beings because of the force of the blows had been too strong and no soft tissue had been damaged. Also, going along with that, like their really valuable stuff, like their cameras and their shoes and jackets and stuff, all of that remained there. None of that was stolen or anything, so theft wasn't an issue. And I feel like if there was like an indigenous attack on them, there's an absence of physical injury by human to human.
Yeah.
There's also all this stuff that I feel like they would have taken, you know?
Yeah, definitely looting would have happened.
Yeah, looting, if it was people to people. Not even if it was just the indigenous, but if it was people to people, they would have taken probably a lot more of their stuff.
Yeah. So. Unless they were trying to make it look like it was natural, which definitely would have been more like thought out and planned.
It still doesn't explain the force of the blow, though.
It doesn't. But like, we can't say that like someone didn't go in with something capable of doing that.
Oh, definitely. You know, for sure.
Like if it was very, very well thought out, I mean, I guess the only option is a car. If someone brought in some kind of vehicle and literally just like ran into them.
But there would have been traces of that.
That's true. That's true.
Tire marks, unless they meticulously got rid of the marks after, but
I mean, because they did say the track stopped after that pine tree, like they were covered up. So unless it all happens there, which is where we start to find the dead bodies. But like, I don't know, you know, just an idea. Okay. Next up, it was later reported that eyewitnesses in the Northern Urals saw fast moving balls of fire. That's sketchy. In the night sky around the time of the Dilatov Pass incident, it had been suggested plausibly that these were Soviet missiles or rocket tests. But another theory, and here we encounter the earliest paranormal explanation of the incident, holds that the fireballs, whatever they in fact may have been, exploded or emitted beam of unspecified energy that directly caused the skiers' deaths, possibly UFOs.
Ooh, okay, I like this theory a lot.
Yeah.
Because I feel, you know, UFOs always show up in really remote places.
Yeah.
Like in the U.S., they're always in like the Southwest, you know, or like in the desert somewhere. That's like UFO land, you know?
Yeah.
But or somewhere out in the wilderness. And I kind of like that theory because, you know, it's a tell all. Like a UFO could have came down, landed, blasted a tree, because it explains the whole tree that got blasted, all the branches off of it.
Yeah.
So if a UFO came down and landed and blasted a tree or something, it obviously isn't going to leave any marks on the ground. It's not going to damage any skin. It's going to kill them internally, but it's not going to damage any skin with like, you know, like what with rocks and sticks and bullets or a missile blast would have done. So
yeah,
I don't know. I like that theory. I do believe in UFOs. I don't know. You know, there's no other proof. That sounds the most likely. And that's kind of sad to say that the UFO explanation is the most likely, but
well, I mean, with UFOs being credited as a natural source from the US government literally last year, like right when coronavirus started, they literally disclosed that UFOs are a real thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, you can't even discredit Navy, this.
It's like, here's a UFO. And then everybody was so focused on COVID. They're just like, oh, the US government literally just confirmed UFOs and no one cares.
What a convenient time to release that information. That's all I'm going to say.
Dun, dun, dun.
Well, okay. The only thing, conspiracy
theorist over here.
Yeah, to an extent, like I don't believe in a lot of conspiracy theories, but I do like to hear them out.
Me too.
It's interesting.
I like to, well, obviously with this podcast, we like to kind of talk about it. I'm not a conspiracy theorist myself. I don't like promoting false information, but I do like to dissect all of them.
Yeah, the only ones, like, I'm not even a conspiracy theorist. I just believe in the ones that have been true. Like, for example, Monarch Programming was literally disclosed. Like, that was an actual program. You can't say it wasn't a thing. Like, those that get declassified.
MK Ultra, yeah, available MK Ultra. In the show.
Yep.
Also available.
So, like, I'm not even, yeah, it's like, I can't even call myself a conspiracy theorist, right? Because it's only, like, true theories that I believe in.
There's always a little bit of truth to something, you know?
That's true.
And I feel like with conspiracy theories, there obviously was a little bit of truth to get them started.
Yeah.
But then they, of course, blow out of proportion. And this also might be a major conspiracy theory.
That's true.
You know, they may just died of hypothermia and we'll just never know. But
so the question I have, though, with the UFOs, because, like, if we're taking in all the evidence, I guess we should piece it by piece. Like, the radiation could be caused by a UFO if it shot some kind of, like, laser out of it, right? Maybe, but it only hit one person.
I'm not an expert on UFO weapons and propulsion technology, but
I mean, but if we're going to say they're using lasers, it's probably going to have radiation.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it's, yeah.
So if we're going to even use that theory, what does that mean? That it, like, lasered one person possibly and then ran into everyone else?
Well, I think the radiation theory could also be, you know, I mean, this is the Soviet Union in Russia. This is the time of Chernobyl.
Yeah.
Like, just because somebody has radiation on their jacket may not mean that has anything to do with this specific incident.
Could just be where someone was living.
Yeah, or working. I mean, in Russia, I came across abandoned towns all the time because of radioactive leaks and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There's literally a city outside of Yekaterinburg that is a Chernobyl city. It's the less popular Chernobyl. You never hear about it.
Yeah, that's true.
It was a completely evacuated town. So the fact of the matter is there's a lot of radiation in Russia, especially during this time when they're building, you know, nuclear power plants in every single town.
And testing them in every single city,
so,
too.
So I don't know. I want to be skeptical on that, but it could have something to do with it. Could not. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
I don't know. This UFO one is more plausible than the avalanche. I'll say that. Like, it's definitely more plausible than any avalanche of any sort.
That's how crazy this story is.
Yeah. But I don't know. I'm not completely bought in, only because of, like, the buried bodies, people in the river. Them, like, trying to take clothes off of their comrades, it looks like, possibly.
Comrade. Yeah, I can get behind that. One thing that I do want to talk about is the Discovery Channel documentary. I actually watched this, too. It's on YouTube. It's called The Russian Yeti.
Ooh.
The Killer Lives.
Fuck. What an epic title, The Killer Lives.
It's basically, so it's put on by this American explorer. His name's Mike Lebecki. He's ridiculous, honestly. Like, this is just clickbait at this point.
Who is he? Oh, American explorer. Okay.
He's just some explorer. Yeah. He reinvestigates the mystery, but what he uncovers is truly horrifying. This is taken from it, by the way.
Okay.
Following the trail of evidence, Mike finds proof that the hikers were not alone. Proof. A photograph taken by one of the hikers a day before they died that suggests they encountered a Yeti.
Okay, is that true, though? Is there an actual photograph?
There is a photograph, but it doesn't, it's bullshit. Like, it's you can't see it. Like,
okay.
It's a white speck or whatever, and it's like, oh, this, you know, its legs you can't see because of the snow, but it's the Yeti. It's just, like I said, it's clickbait, but yeah. It's a ridiculous documentary that's totally, the guy's a conspiracy theory guy. But according to the documentary, the Dyatlov group met their deaths at the hands of a Yeti, also known as an abominable snowman. It's been rumored that the Yeti-like beasts inhabit the wilds of Siberia. Mike Lebecki said, "The Dyatlov Pass incident proves they're real. When I found one of the students was missing a tongue immediately, I knew this was not caused by an avalanche," Lebecki said. "Something ripped out the tongue of this woman. That something," Lebecki naturally concluded, "could only have been a Yeti."
Okay, let me just say this real quick. With how big I'm sure he's supposing this Yeti is, does that have small enough fingers to even rip out a tongue?
Probably not. Not at all.
Yeah.
And it's like you're saying with scavengers, that's the first thing scavengers go for is a tongue.
Yeah.
When someone dies, their mouth usually opens. And if it's frozen open, that's the first thing a scavenger is going to go for is the eyeballs and the tongue.
Yeah.
It's the most edible and appealing thing to eat, you know?
For sure.
So this whole thing is, I mean, I just threw it in there because it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
This guy, he's like, it's got to be a Yeti. She's missing her tongue.
Fucking idiot. This guy just doesn't know science. He probably knows he's like spewing shit, you know?
Oh, he does. Like, it's the fact that it made it on the Discovery Channel is even more humorous. Like, why don't you know, the Discovery Channel should give us our own show.
Yeah. Yeah. No, legit.
We at least have a little bit more science than this guy.
Yeah. If they're crediting him, credit us.
Not saying we're perfect, obviously, but you know, we're we actually respect science in the regard that, you know, just because someone's missing their tongue, oh shit, it's a Yeti.
Yeah. Well, and also to speak, because like as a teacher, I use Discovery Channel documentaries a lot, like, or at least I have the option of doing so. I'm not the teacher that plays movies all day, just to make that be known. But Discovery Channel.
That's the best kind of teacher, though.
Well, that's what the students like.
Whenever I walked in and I saw that TV and sitting in the middle of the room, I'm like, hell yeah.
Let's fucking go.
Either there's a sub or we're not doing shit today.
Yeah,
you know?
Both. So, yeah, no, but like Discovery Channel lately, like I'm talking last 5 years, has actually released some really good documentaries. Like I teach world studies and science. So we do a unit on ancient China. And there's like really good documentaries that go over like what the ancient China was built for, like secret tunnels they had, like how it worked, how they built it back then. And like, it was extensive, like, and it was actually a series too. So just to say, like, Discovery Channel now is amazing. I'm not sure how good it was back then, but like, it sounds like they were just putting anything on that show, you know?
What channel does the Finding Bigfoot?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think I've seen that one.
Oh, I think it might be Animal Planet, but it's just basically all these like crazy hicks trying to find Bigfoot.
Oh, like, shit, I think I watched
that. They're on like season 10 and they still haven't found Bigfoot.
Yeah, they're gonna be searching for a while. I'll go out there since I'm hairy as fuck. I'll just get on some stilts.
Like, just give us one episode where you actually find the damn thing. That's all we want.
No, because then their show's done, bro. They're not gonna make any money. They'll be looking for days. Season 100 coming up.
But go ahead and go into this last hypothesis. This one is actually really interesting. It's one of my favorite ones.
The infrasound? Mm-hmm. Okay. So we got the infrasound hypothesis. Author Donnie Aker proposed in his 2013 book, Dead Mountain, the untold true story of the Dilatov Pass incident, that the skiers may have been driven to hysteria by infrared sound waves caused by weather phenomenon known as a Kármán vortex street. In simple terms, the Kármán vortex street is an oscillating pattern that emerges when a fluid or gas, in this instance wind, flows around a suitably shaped object, in the instance a topographical feature, the mountain. When they occur on such a large scale, these winds, wind patterns can theoretically generate very low frequency sound waves that have been blamed for harmful physiological and psychological symptoms in human beings. Aker argues that just such a phenomenon may have occurred under extremely high wind conditions on the night of the incident. The resulting bombardment of the skiers by infrared sound waves induce severe panic and cause them to flee the safety of their tent and meet their deaths. Okay, I believe that one. 100%. Yeah,
you
it's
like
that
one.
It's that one.
Because it's the most scientific, right?
Yeah. Well, it's like I teach sixth grade science, which goes over weather patterns. And so this is very plausible. Like the way that we have waves and the way they move over and around hills. Like I definitely buy into this. And I've also heard a lot of theories when it comes to national park missing like scenarios, where infrared sounds are used, like especially if it's a military base. I've heard that like there's a theory that military bases can like emit these sounds based on the generators they're using.
Well,
and it can make people go crazy.
To hop in with that, you remember the M Cave?
Yeah.
That we talked about one of our shows. Yeah. It's available. You can look it back up. It's the M Cave Hiker, where he's literally, one of the theories was that he looked into the cave and saw one of those or heard one of those like distressing sounds and then just walked away.
Yeah.
He got the hell out of there. So this theory I really like, all like you said, the Kármán vortex street. I wish I knew more about it, but it sounds like it could have happened to him.
Well, and also like on the positive note, not to freak people out with conspiracy theories, the good note is this could all be natural, and a lot of like park people getting missing, like in national parks, could be attributed to this vortex, you know, because a lot of them are around mountains and all stuff like that. So
it's absolutely terrifying to me.
Yeah, this is really creepy.
Inducing severe panic and causing them to flee their tent in the middle of the night naked. I mean, that I don't even want to know what that sounds like.
No.
And maybe it's subtle, maybe it's not, but I don't even want to know what that would sound like.
Well, let's just speak to the Utah freaking earthquake we had last year. Like when COVID first started, like remember that was like a grade, what, 6 out of 10, which is not that severe, but like I don't know if you remember. I remember waking up thinking a car hit the side of our house. I literally woke up in a panic until it ended, which it lasted probably about 10 seconds by the time I woke up.
I remember. I live probably 50 miles north of Salt Lake where it happened.
Yeah.
And I still felt it, the aftershocks and stuff.
Yeah.
I was in bed. It did wake me up. I mean, there was rattling. All my dishes were rattling and some were falling off the shelf. Yeah. So, yeah, it was bad.
So, yeah, just like going off the earthquake, I mean, that freaked me out. I mean, imagine whatever this was and then it not lasting 10 seconds, but probably like hours.
I can't even imagine.
Like, because I'm not going to, I couldn't even lie to you. Like if that earthquake was going on for like 2 minutes, I know I would have gotten up naked because I sleep naked. would have probably immediately
TMI. Yeah. We're never going to get any ads now.
You guys are explicit and vulgar.
Damn it, Andrew. But we're trying to make this show for kids.
This is going to be on Discovery Channel. We're trying to get it there. And Kids Are Us. No, but like legit, man. Like if that shit kept going, I'd have been in a panic. I wouldn't have been logically thinking. Probably would have walked out like basically butt naked and like started just looking around, you know, and like freaking out, like grabbing shit and just being in a hurry. Like imagine this like times 10. Like, that's probably what these guys were going through.
Yeah, you know? And you know, the first thing that comes to my mind when we had that earthquake was to go, I mean, what they tell you, obviously, is, like, you know, hide under a desk, go to your bathtub, or stand in a doorway, you know?
Yeah.
I laid in my bed and just sat there, freaked out. Like, yeah. I didn't do anything. I live in a brick house. Like, any minute, that thing could have collapsed on me.
Fuck.
But I just laid in bed, and I was like, what the hell? And it woke me up, too, so that also might have been why I was so freaked out, but... Yeah, well, I agree.
Well, especially with this one, because I think based on what we read on this Karman vortex, it sounds like it's going to be an intense like sound that you hear. Let's see, it generates very low frequency sound waves. So imagine like a super low bassy sound just like vibrating into your ears. That sounds horrible.
And maybe it wasn't even audible. It just was like to a pitch where it drove them insane and they didn't even realize what was happening.
Fuck.
Could also have happened. So what's your theory?
Dude,
to close this out.
It's got to be the infrasound.
Think
that's the most plausible. Like, it has so much good evidence on this, especially with them being all over the fucking place, walking out
with
no
shoes. Do you
think
it's powerful enough though to damage your internal organs, like they were saying?
Oh fuck, I forgot about that. Yeah, the blunt force stuff.
Just think about it. I mean, that would have been like a car crash impact. How about you think about it and I'll give my theory.
Yeah, let's hear yours.
Aliens.
Is that your theory?
Aliens. Yeah.
Aliens.
No, I want to get behind the UFO theory. Yeah. I just like it. It's the only explanation.
Dude, okay. I totally discredited the blunt force trauma that they experienced.
I wonder if this kind of thing though could have caused that though. Like a vibrating so intense that it shook up your organs.
Let me look up this Karman vortex street. I just want to see the Wikipedia page to see if there's anything about like the wind that comes with it, like if it's strong wind.
Sure, because I, you know, if this was actually an actual weather phenomenon, I think it would be more popular, don't you? Like if it actually was so powerful enough to break someone's bones, and maybe to go along with that, you know, maybe they had like ran crazy and were bashing their head into things or running into trees and trying to climb trees. They did say that all those branches were broken. Remember that on the tree?
That's true.
So maybe this thing really is strong enough to break branches and break bones. I don't know. I don't really know a whole lot about it, but.
Okay. So I got a couple things. I'm just going to read what I see and then you can keep talking about it if you want. I'm going to keep reading. But first thing that pops up is that it's a repeating pattern, like we said, of swirling vortices caused by the process known as vortex shedding, which is responsible for the unsteady separation. So this is key right here. It's responsible for the unsteady separation of flow of a fluid around blunt bodies.
Oh, damn.
So it could have like shaken their body to where the fluid was basically like blunt force traumaing everything because there was nothing on the outside. So it could have been the fluids on the inside.
That's even more terrifying now that I think about that.
Yeah, let me keep going.
I don't think I'm ever going to go outdoors.
Dude, honestly, I know. Like after shit like this, I'm like, fuck, I'm staying inside for the rest of my life. Never coming out.
Right.
So I don't think I need to keep reading because I think that's enough evidence right there where if it's going to shake your fluids on the inside, it could definitely.
It's possible. It's plausible.
Okay.
It is, definitely.
Does that change your alien?
Nope. I'm still going to stick with alien theory.
Okay.
Are you going to still stick with this Karman Street, whatever it's called? Yeah. Karman.
Well, okay. With the government announcing that UFOs are a thing, I'm still convinced that like the UFOs could just be a human phenomenon. Like we've created them.
Sure.
But like, dude, this infrasound wind thing with the Karman vortex street is just too convincing. And especially as a science teacher, like I'm all about it.
Yeah.
This makes a lot of sense.
Okay. And I feel that.
And especially since no one knows about it, like you made the comment that like, why do people not know about this? That's probably why there's so many conspiracy theories. No one knows that this is a thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you do now. All of our 10 listeners now know.
Dude, we get more listens than that.
Get it. We have a couple thousand. We're happy about it.
Yeah. We get some good listens.
But share it with your friends. We want more.
Yes, definitely. And get on our Patreon because we got that up and going.
Yeah. And I mean, if we're going to go into that, let's just go ahead and close out this episode.
Yeah. All right. So this is season 3, episode 9, Dial the Top Pass. Thanks for tuning in to our show. Me and Hunter are super happy to be back. We love the show. We're happy to keep it going. Once again, give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts if that's where you listen, or any platform of choice that you have if it allows you to leave a rating. Make sure to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We got the Facebook for the old people of the show. We got the Instagram for the millennials and Gen Z. We got the Twitter for the annoying people that don't look up good sources. Don't at me, but I'm adding you.
And we don't have a YouTube yet. It's still too toxic. So
yeah, eventually, you know what? That's the thing though.
Maybe when all these 12-year-olds grow up, turn 15, we'll have a YouTube.
Yeah. No, I'm definitely down for the YouTube. It's like, that's why we got this Patreon, right? If we can get some income from that, we'll definitely get into YouTubing and getting a studio set up. So that'd be awesome. But that's down the road stuff. We're happy with how our things are right now.
Join our Patreon. You can help direct the show. You know, yeah. You can give us suggestions on ways you want this show to go forward. We are totally open to that. Totally fine.
And you get a drink with us once yes. a month if you go for the Dark Master subscription.
But Dark Daddy.
Dark Daddy. And that's a funny thing too. We should definitely allow it, like Dark Daddies or Dark Masters. Like, they could definitely subscribe for a month if they just wanted to shoot the shit with us, you know, for 1 month, and then go back down to a different subscription.
I don't know if I want to shoot the shit with people named Dark Daddy.
Dude, I'll shoot the shit with Dark Daddies. I am a Dark Daddy.
All right. Well, we'll keep you posted on more updates with the Patreon and, like Andrew was saying, the merch. We're excited to keep this going in a good direction.
Yeah.
And we're happy to be back into it. So once again, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
See ya. Hey, hey.